It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
All right, away we go. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have y'all here. Captain Mike.
Captain Sean, how you doing today? Looks like we're finally getting a little spring weather coming our way.
Tell you what, it was all I could do this week not to go listen.
I'm sure they're yodeling this morning.
I just said, you know, I got to wait a little bit. Let me get some other stuff done as I'm trying to put my life together back after, you know, deer season and small game season. Got to do a little rabbit hunting last weekend and do that. And so I said, well,
get some rabbits.
We got some rabbits.
Okay.
Got
we haven't talked.
Yeah, we have not. No pre-talk on this one. We just get in here and do the show. So, had a buddy with some dogs and had a good hunt. A good hunt. And it was, you know, to me, it's like, I don't know. I've been so few times, I don't know how to judge it versus another one. But everybody seemed to have fun. The dogs seemed to have a big time. And we killed rabbits. So,
yeah.
You know, it was good.
How many rabbits you get?
We got three.
Three. Okay.
Three and... So it was this combination of the cover. This guy had asked me, say, how thick's the cover? I said, it's thick. And he got out there. He said, you know, you're the first person that's lived up to what they're saying. I said, what? He said, most people tell me they got thick cover, and I get out there, and it's not real thick cover.
Yeah.
We had rabbits going everywhere we couldn't shoot.
Yeah.
Because you'd be like, up, oh, there he is, up.
Oh. Yeah, you got to be quick on a rabbit.
We didn't have the lanes. Like, when we could get them up where we had a lane, we could shoot them. But the other stuff, I mean, you could see a rabbit for about a tenth of a second. He's making a loop. But it doesn't matter because you'd see the grass moving or something. You couldn't. So
and the dogs are barking, and the rabbit is about a half a mile in front of them.
Yeah, it's going. They were going. It was a real good time. Good time. And funny, you know, after our last two shows talk about habitat management and quail to some degree, these beagles, obviously quail dogs too. They pushed up a covey of quail, and one of the guys snapped up and shot the quail. So we got a quail in with our mix. With rabbits and quail. You can see, I put some pictures up on the Instagram page. I'll try to get some on the Facebook as well. But yeah, it was fun. Good time. Yeah. So this last week, trying to put stuff back together instead of going to listen. But I wanted to listen.
I can imagine, yeah.
Speaking of turkeys. Now, coming up on the show, we're talking to Scott Bannon. We're going to talk trigger fish season. We're going to talk some fishing here. Trigger fish season opening, what they're talking about doing with amberjack, trying to have some state control of amberjack. At least that's the idea. And what the preliminary stuff for snapper might be. So we'll get in that conversation a little bit. But
you don't sound like you're happy about that.
No, I'm not. I'm not. And we'll talk about the possibilities. Nothing's in stone on snapper yet, but it's concrete starting to get dry. So
it's a crazy world.
So we'll wait for a second. Let's talk about something else that'll be it probably contentious as well in the hunting world. Now, this is – and I'm going to try to get between now and – turkey season, get different players with different opinions in on this. And that is we've been talking about for a while, the questions around the turkey population in Alabama and what's going on. And the way they measure that is by poults per hen, how many biddies per hen. And I think 2.1 is the holding steady. Anything below 2.1,
so you're losing 2.1 population. Biddies to every hen.
Right. And then, they average it out though, because if one had six, she could count, you know, they don't make it perk, they just average it.
Okay. Yeah. Because some might have none, some might have two, some might have 12.
Right.
Yeah.
So they try to average it. But that number has been steady or declining. I think Alabama's been at like 1.9. I don't have that story in front of me right now, but we'll talk about it on a further show. So, and people, that's the science. And anecdotally, except for a few folks, I think most folks will tell you that the turkey hunting's not what it was.
Yeah.
I mean, you just hear that from, and that's from dang people in northern Alabama, central Alabama, south Alabama. It's not even kind of regional. It's been around the state. So some of the research they did initially was finding that hens didn't have poults. And we've all seen that over the years. And you assume they lost the nest, the poults got eaten. I mean, a turkey nest and baby poults are on the menu for about everything in the woods. It's
that's
a carnivore.
Right.
Okay. And in the sky.
I don't know how they make any.
Right. It's an amazing thing. The amazing when you shoot a grown gobbler, the amazing circumstance that had to happen for that critter to be alive to be in front of you. So a lot of us assumed over the years that, okay, well, the reason why we don't have these poults is that hen lost her nest or whatever. Well, they did research, and in a lot of these hens, they had not been bred.
Isn't that amazing?
And
it is.
That was really shocking to me,
yeah,
that they had not been bred. And they went in further in some of the, and this is preliminary research, because I know there's a bunch of different opinions out there, and we're going to try over the weeks to make sure we get different opinions and, you know, people that come at it from science. Different.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not going to just say, Mike and Sean say they heard a guy down at the Exxon station, you know, but so we're.
While he's eating a biscuit.
Right. This guy said, so he was back there at the beef jerky. He must be right.
Yeah.
But we're going to try to get different and try to make sure we get all the information, then we can process this. But we do know we have a problem. Now, is that problem something we can solve? Something that's caused by us? Is it. So one of the pieces of research out there, and Dr. Mike Chamberlain out of University of Georgia. He's a turkey doc. You find him online. He's really a smart guy.
Yeah.
Was saying in some of this preliminary research that we were shooting, and other people too, he wasn't the only one, but we're shooting the gobblers too early. And you look at the peak of nesting, kind of like we look at the peak of breeding for setting seasons and the rut and all that. The peak of nesting for turkeys about mid-April. Okay.
Yeah.
That is what the – and there is everything's a bell curve. There's early, there's late.
Sure.
There's different parts of the state.
Sure.
But April 15th. And are we shooting those toms before they can, you know, get those hens bred? And one of the things in the research I thought was interesting is kind of an adjunct to it was this idea I'd always had that you kill this gobbler, dominant gobbler, whatever. You kill that dominant, you kill him. I figured by that afternoon – there'd be one of those other gobblers would be stepping up to his husbandly duties, right?
That's what I would
me
assume,
too.
Too.
I thought it, they say, in fact, no.
That doesn't make sense.
That they have to reestablish. This is interesting. This is, once again, what their research was saying. I know, because I'm dancing around this because there's a lot of different opinions.
Sure.
But their research saying that it takes, the hens aren't going to just breed with any gobbler. It's kind of different than the deer conversation that some of the research says this idea that only the big bucks breed is wrong.
No, I know that for a fact.
Okay.
You're right. Yes.
It sounds like this is actually flipped, and it is what in the research that they have to reestablish a pecking order. And, you know, which by the way, I'm going to show you a video too of some pecking order going on in our woods. The gobbler's got to reassess who's boss. And then the hens seem to select the dominant gobbler over the other gobblers. So in the process of us shooting that boss gobbler, and while the gobblers sorted out amongst themselves who's boss, and then the hens recognizing who's boss.
Can take a while.
Can take a while.
Sure.
So the research says the value of that gobbler, this is just on the population. That's not talking about I want older age class. This is on the population and having more turkeys. That it is so important to keep every day or every week you can keep a gobbler alive, a dominant gobbler, is so important for breeding those hens. Once the hen breeding is over, they said they're completely expendable.
Yeah.
You can shoot them, you know. Because the question was, would they push to reduce limits or move season time? And it's been a back and forth. But what I hear a lot is you can keep a limit at 5 if you shoot them later.
Yeah.
They experimented on some WMAs this last year with moving the season later. Of course, that research is going to take a long time to bear fruit and see what happens there. We have seen our season date move a little bit. The idea is, do they move it again? Giving you the same number of days, but pushing it further into May. Now, we're now closing that first weekend in May.
Like, none of us would mind that at all if the 1st of May wasn't 90 degrees.
Right.
Now,
but
know,
the question, but
yeah.
and I'm with you. And the problem is I got a boot in both worlds. And once again, if this research is accurate, I would like to hunt when I want to hunt, but I want there to be turkeys for everyone.
Sure.
Now, on private land,
we
I have
do.
The luxury of being able to limit, you know, unless somebody else comes on there. But, I mean, myself, limit when we hunt them, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I don't want the best turkey populations on every piece of public land, every hunting club, everything out there. And so if the idea is that I got to hunt when it's hot or I got to get it, yes, I want it like it used to be. I want to be turkey hunting in 2 weeks, okay?
Yeah.
But I also want there to be turkeys. And I've seen from the 1990s to now a big difference in turkey populations.
Well, there was not that many people turkey hunting back in 1970, 1980, up 1990. There really wasn't. So there was vast amounts of land that people
turkeys
deer hunted,
just, right.
But nobody turkey hunted it. So those turkey got to do mm-hmm. their whole thing the whole season mm-hmm. with no problem. So they would populate the next door neighbors where right. there was turkey hunting.
And we always thought it was okay because, you know, in turkeys, unlike deer, we're not trying to keep the population check. We want to get big. We leave the hens. And in the old mentality of deer world, one buck could breed all those does. And I'm pointing at myself. I used to think,
well
one
all
gobbler could breed every.
Yeah.
They said that eventually they could, but this when you shoot a dominant gobbler, how long it takes to reestablish who's the boss and who gets to breed. And those hens select the dominant gobbler. They've done the studies. Like, here's all these gobblers, and the hens wait around for the dominant gobbler, which is pretty darn interesting.
Yeah.
Now, there are people saying that this population dynamic is not because of taking these. It's a bunch of other things. Habitat. We have less habitat, and they go down the list of other things. So there's debate about this. I don't think there's settled science. But this is a question that's coming from the Conservation Advisory Board to figure out if they're going to move yet later with the start of turkey season.
Yeah.
You know, states all over the Southeast are dealing with this. What does it mean? And once again, from this science, there's other science, there's other research out there. From this science, it says, like, every day or every week that you hold off on starting, you make this big improvement in number of hens bred. And you bring that poult per hen, where we started, number up beyond just holding even and starting to improve. This is going to be a debate going forward. We'll be covering it right here on this show. All right. Something nowhere near as contentious as offshore fishing for reef species. We'll talk about that coming up with Scott Bannon. Stay right there. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. We're glad you're here. Remember, check us out, facebook.com/FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. So hit that part. You go to the other Facebook page, too, but the Outdoors one is where you get this stuff.
That's where you get the hunting and the fishing.
That's right.
Yeah, we get to talk to a retiree.
Yes, from one of the gigs, but still, you know, we're talking to him in his entity as the Director of Marine Resources for the state of Alabama. Our friend Scott Bannon joins us now. Hey, Scott.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Good morning, guys. I said I'm glad, as a retiree, I'm 29 years old and 30 years in the Coast Guard. I feel like I did pretty good.
Well, we thank you for your service to us.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No, it was a pleasure and an honor to serve. I promise you that.
We're going to have to get, maybe even on the midday show, get Scott to come in and tell some stories and things he saw in the Coast Guard. I just heard a few of them, and there's some great, I mean, exciting story. I mean, not when you were there in person, but for me hearing it secondhand, some exciting stories.
Well, I've been on a few that are in person, and there's a few that I think the statute of limitations have expired. And I can talk about.
Good deal. Yeah. So yes, y'all put that in the notes. Upcoming program, we're gonna get the behind the scenes with Scott Bannon from Coast Guard Days. But let's talk about Alabama Marine Resources Days. I was talking with Congressman Carl the other day on the midday show, and I passed on one of those one sheets from former Congressman Byrne when we talked about the value of fishing here along the Gulf Coast, and every day it's open, what it means, and resources, I mean, and revenue, and we'll get into that. So the more days we can be offshore fishing is good for the economy and good for those of us that like to fish. So let's talk about it. March 1st, right? We got a Monday coming up Monday. I guess that's Monday. We get to go back to, what, catching triggers?
Catching trigger fish. So it's going to open in state and federal waters on March 1st. And if the weather holds like it's been doing, it ought to be some great opportunities. And what we've been seeing in the trigger fish world the last couple of years, you know, it's been rebounding, and it's been a great for Alabama anglers. So we're excited about it. And the one difference this year is we have added great trigger fish and greater amberjack to the snapper check program because of the value that trigger fish have to the state and the data that we already collect through the University of South Alabama, through the program that we have looking at the abundance off the state of Alabama. It just helps us confirm that. And so that's new for this year. Our officers will be out, you know, reminding folks to do it and helping them download the app. And it's new muscle memory.
Okay. I want to come back to that, but I want to talk about anecdotally. I know Mike and I can sit here and tell you, and I'm sure a lot of people nod along with us. There's a lot of trigger fish. When when we're catching triggerfish on circle hooks that are for snapper, they're big and they're hungry. I mean, there's a lot of them. How many are there? I mean, do you have any? Are you talking about the University of South Alabama? I mean, are they? Can they tell you in tonnage increase, percentage increase? What's the science saying?
They do. So it's similar to red snapper. So when they look at the abundance offshore using their ROVs and then what we call long line surveys, vertical line surveys, there's several different methods to look at the species out there, the reef fish. And so the trend that we've seen in triggerfish is up, and so that is good, and with a little bit of a levelness to it. So we're confident with what we see off the state of Alabama. It doesn't mean you see that everywhere. And on the federal side of the house, you know, the assessments and some other things take a little time to catch up to that. But we get a snapshot every year of what those species look like. And so, again, it's on an upward trend, and that's good news for us here in Alabama. Because also, just as a side note, the lionfish has kind of gone down and stabilized, which is good. We can live with stable. We don't want to see an increase in lionfish.
Now, you attribute that to the people shooting them, spear gunning them, collecting them out there, or is it some natural process beyond that?
I think it's a combination of things. You know, there has been a lot of effort by spearfishing tournaments and other people to go after them for commercial purposes and just for the fact to get rid of them because they are a very tasty fish. They just don't bite a hook. But the other part of it is it's probably just the environment and kind of the normal order of things that it starts to work itself out and find an equilibrium out there.
We did find out that grouper do eat them.
They do.
Yes. So that could be a factor.
To develop that, you know, that, hey, this is a new thing. But especially things like the Goliath grouper, they've known that in the Bahamas early on that some of them will do it. And occasionally sharks will eat them. Again, it's like eating the cactus, you know, with the spines on it. So,
they may eat them once and not the second time. But and the threat from lionfish, other than, I mean, I don't want invasives in our system at all, but wasn't to individual fish, right? It was to their eggs? Wasn't that the, am I thinking?
Well, no, it's to the juveniles.
The juveniles.
What they do, they are voracious eaters, and they will gorge themselves with, you know, you get a less than 1 pound lionfish, and he'll have 30 or 40 juvenile reef fish in its gut. Like, they'll be bloated. They've eaten so much. And they're the perfect enemy. Things don't like to eat the lionfish, and they also don't like to eat the eggs. And they can release like 30,000 eggs a month, and they float in the system. And apparently that has a bitter taste, and I don't know who discovered that it's a bitter taste, but the fish don't like the eggs.
Okay, so and coming back to triggers for a second here, when we talk about the you're getting these snapshots on the improvement of the population, is it, because I'm thinking about it, and we're going to talk about snapper later on in the show, is it that the average size of the trigger is getting bigger that's causing this, or are there more individual trigger fish? I mean,
a little bit of both. The abundance, and I should have looked it up ahead of time and told you what all those numbers and what that size is, but the size does increase a little bit, but you also, it's really about the abundance and what we see on those reefs and in that survey. So we're very comfortable here with what we're seeing out there, and so we just want to be able to confirm that data any way that you can substantiate what you're seeing, and so that when we go talk to the federal government and say this is what we're seeing and this is how we've confirmed it, you know, it's always good to have that extra evidence.
How much improvement has to be there for co-fishing, in other words, to have trigger open when snappers open, or so we can have some duplication. We can go out and catch multiple species.
So trigger is controlled by NOAA with the seasons and the allocations and all those things, whereas like red snapper, we control the season dates and we're given an allocation. So there is potential, and I said it before, that if we can get red snapper stabilized, we can be creative with our seasons, and we can adjust it. And last year we did have an opportunity late in the year where trigger, amberjack, and snapper were all open at the same time. And of course, the weather was terrible, and we've been post-storm and those other things. It was very, very difficult to get out there, but we did have an opportunity for that, and I think people like that.
Oh, absolutely we do. And what is the limit on trigger fish, Scott?
So it's one per person, and unfortunately, it's a 15-inch fork length. So it's a pretty good-sized fish, but most of the people I've been talking to that have been seeing them and what we saw on the research trips, that's not that big of a challenge.
What about regulations on terminal tackle, hook style?
So, okay, it's still the circle hook. You have to do that, and there is a little bit of a change that's coming down under the Descend Act that for reef fish, you're going to have either the descend device or descending device of some sort, or the needle or some kind of tool to
a venting tool,
the air.
Right? The same venting tool that you got to have for snapper, you're gonna have to have for trigger.
And for any reef fish, and it's passed. It was a federal law that was passed, codified and put into regulation. So that'll come. But there's also some money out there to provide them free of charge. And I'll come back later when that program is in place and talk to folks about how they can get that and exactly how that rule will be applied. So for this year, if you have it, use it. They do seem to work. And some people just enjoy, hooking the fish back up and lowering it back down to where they caught it from. And so that's an effort to help reduce some of the predators from getting it, ensuring the fish goes back down due to barotrauma. So,
yeah, but I want to ask this question here. If we're doing it, and I understand. I mean, I watch it first. I understand the science, and I watch myself do it, the value in venting a fish going back down. But if that is part of the, if this federal law comes in because it says part of the take or the tonnage is based on, fish not making it back down, predators, or them dying, floating on the surface or whatever, then if we have widespread acceptance of venting or the Descend Act stuff, shouldn't that give us credit for fish back into the tonnage we can catch?
That's from my perspective. I think we should start to see that, and because again, the dead discards is a challenge to the fishery, and that as this progresses, we should see a credit. I think that's a good way to look at it for the reduction in dead discards, and so there is some potential that comes out of this. And again, I'm thankful that there is a program to get these in the hands of people for no cost. And that'll be good too to help people to buy into it without quote buying in.
Well, yeah, and I think the buy-in. I know this is not in y'all's control, but from my lips to Washington's ears, if the value of engaging in this program is to mitigate that the dead discard and the, then by the nature of that should equal more fish that we could catch.
And. You know me, Sean. I'm a realist, and again, my prayer is that's what happens. And stand by, because it may take a few years to see any realization of that. But that's the goal: is that we do get improved numbers that we get to catch and retain based on the reduction in dead discards.
All right, got to about 30 seconds here before the break. So triggerfish open as of March 1st, Monday. Then goes till when? Do we not know?
So tentatively, it goes through the end of May. NOAA could come out and say that based on their estimates from last year, they're going to close it early. They did it a few years ago where we only had a 12-day season, but right now they have not made a determination. The state will close when the feds close on that.
So it's TFN, and just watch for that notice.
Yes, for the announcement, and we'll share it on our Facebook page and make public announcements as well.
All right, coming right back, more with Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon, right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Right, we're back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward. Our guest, Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon, and talking trigger fishing first. So as of Monday, that's open. Now, as we start picking our way around the pyramids and the chicken coops and all those things out there, Scott, what about amberjack? What's the situation right now with those jokers?
Okay, so amberjack has an interesting season. It runs from August to September. So we are on the tail end of last year's landing. So it would have it opened last August, and then to determine the spring season, we have to get the final data from NOAA, and for the final wave of the year is how they accumulate that data, and they will set the season. So it's tentatively scheduled to open May 1st. That's when the season is eligible to be open. But the but they don't have the final wave of data to say what they caught last fall to be able to provide the season dates just yet. So we're hoping that it goes ahead and we get the opportunity to catch them, but we won't know that until a little later.
You know, last year, Scott, I went out opening weekend of amberjack season, and you would have thought it was opening weekend of snapper season. I mean, well, one thing, it was a beautiful weekend. Everybody had been cooped up with COVID and everything, but it was unbelievable how many people were out there and how many people were offshore 70 miles where I was. It was like a traffic jam out there. Now, when you have triggerfish coming in this coming Monday, I've never been opening weekend of triggerfish. That don't excite me to go out and catch one triggerfish and take four people and catch four triggerfish. Is that going to be very many people going, you think, opening weekend?
Well, again, it's hard to say because people have been cooped up because of COVID. Earlier this week, during the good weather, it's the middle of the week in February, and the boat ramps were full because people were just taking advantage of the opportunity to catch sheep's head or something to get out and get in the boat. You know, deer season had ended. You know, we're talking turkeys now. The cabin fever had set in. The snowbirds are taking advantage of the opportunities that they get this time of year. And so I think that you will see people that have the opportunity to go, they'll go, and then they'll look for, you know, beeliners and some other things that are going to be open at the same time.
And before we start talking about amberjack real quick, too, now, once trigger season opens, it doesn't – you can go every day of the week.
You can. It's not a season. It's straight through until NOAA makes the announcements of what the closure date will be.
Okay. And how are they – because this is not, and we're going to go back to talking about reporting here, but how are they making their measure of how many triggerfish are being caught?
So they use the MRIP survey that we participate in as a state. We do the dockside surveys when you see our staff at the docks. And so that takes time to bring all that data together from all the states. And so that's why there's such a time lag, and that's why the state systems are so much faster for in-season quota monitoring like Snapper Check does, so that we can make adjustments quickly so we don't go over. NOAA has to make an estimate based on effort, so that's what we'll see with triggerfish and see what the amberjack numbers were from the fall.
Let's walk us through that, because we've all, you know, used to those fish snapper, used to doing Snapper Check. How we do it, is it, if we open it up on our app, is it going to be, say, triggerfish, or how?
It's all in the same app, same as the Red Snapper. You'll open that app, go to OutdoorAlabama.com, the OA app, and or you can do it online, but the easiest way is to do it through the app. And it's in your account, just like you would have had before if you were doing Snapper Check before.
Because I'm doing it right now, yeah. So I hit the Snapper Check button?
Yes.
Okay.
And then it'll give you the options, and it may not show up just
it's not
yet
up
because
yet.
It's
yeah.
closed.
Okay, but we will go. It won't say trigger check. It'll just be under the snapper check.
Under snapper check, and it'll say trigger fish will be an option in there. So it'll show up. I've already asked that we make sure that it's in the system set to turn on Monday, and we'll go out there on Monday just to make sure. And that's what they do. You report it exactly the same. It's the same questions that you had for snapper check. It stores the information. If you either have an account or once you've put your vessel number in there, the hardest question to answer is that vessel ID number. And it's stored, and you're good to go. It takes about 15 or 20 seconds. And it has the offline function, so you can actually do it offshore. You'll need to open the app up when you have service for it to be updated. But after your first trip, you know, that'll happen. So,
yeah, and I mean, it's, you know, even if you don't do that, I mean, by the time you get, I'm not going to speak for every carrier, but by the lighthouse, you should have signal.
Most of them start to get a signal, yes.
And so you have to open the app back up for it to make
no,
your...
Once,
he said
once
he wants you open
the
it
app
up.
Has been updated, so if Monday morning before you go out, you make sure that it's updated, you can fill it out on the offline function, and if you come in, it will automatically do it on its own. You don't have to do anything.
Okay, good. Good.
But he's saying open it up once while you have signal before you go out, right?
That's correct. Scott?
Okay. All right, then into this amberjack discussion. So, you know, Mike was talking about the number of people out for amberjack, and we had this is part of our snapper discussion. that the participation rates, because people couldn't go do all these other things, which I don't know. Mike and I don't have that problem. We don't have other hobbies, but these other people had other hobbies shut down and couldn't go to the baseball game or do this and that, all came fishing. What about that?
And that will be an issue this year because people are playing baseball this year.
Yeah,
they are.
So let me tell you, last year when the kids weren't playing baseball, there was a lot of people out in that Gulf of Mexico. But when the kids are playing baseball, most parents and grandparents are going to be at the game on Saturday.
They are, and we saw that, and I even talked, I believe I even shared it with you guys, with people who, once I explained that to them, and they realized, oh, that's us. You know, we're taking more people because now the kids are going with us, and we're taking more trips because we're not traveling to play, you know, travel soccer, softball, baseball.
Yep.
This year, things are starting to open up, and, you know, our prayer is that things really start to open up all over the country and that we get past this. I know we all are praying for a safe exit out of this pandemic, but it's certainly impacted fishing, all levels of fishing, whether it's inshore or offshore. The participation has been very high.
And snapper, too. I'm sure that was part of the reason for.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there is no doubt, and we can show you in the numbers of how many people went fishing, and it was higher than it was when we first did the exempted fishing permit and had those opening weekends. And I would have never thought we could have done that, but we did. And boat sales have still been very high. So there are some good things. You know, we always focus on the negative, it seems like, in the media, but there are some good things going on. In coastal Alabama, and I think fishing and outdoor activities has been a benefit. The commissioner, Chris Blankenship, has supported that from the beginning and worked with the governor and the health officer to ensure that we're doing those things safely.
All right, I'll be that person in the media that's on the negative. Snapper, 2021.
Oh, you had to go straight to the negative.
Yeah, well, I got to get the, before we finish up on this show, I got to get to the meat of it, Director Bannon. So. With what you know right now, what are we looking at?
So, I'm going to plead the fifth. So, unfortunately, at this time, I can't even tell you what we will open, like when, what the dates will be. We haven't even really sat down and considered some dates yet because we're working with a challenge that they call calibration at the federal level. So if that goes into effect, where we're trying to take the snapper check numbers, turn them back into federal numbers, so to speak, and they call it currency, they're saying that we need to reduce Alabama's fishing by about half and that we would go to 547,000 pounds instead of the 1.2 million pounds that we had last year. And I'm in complete disagreement with that. I don't think the science is there for that. I don't think that the economics are there for that.
But y'all can't, so people understand, while the state sets the dates for the season, the allowable tonnage is still dictated by the feds.
That's correct. So,
and
so
they
we
say
have to take
half.
What they give us.
Half.
Yeah.
Half.
That means two weekends at
no,
best.
If in Alabama, with the way that we fish,
mm-hmm.
we would create panic fishing.
Yep.
If we opened for 4 days, I think we would consume and potentially go over in 4 days if the weather is good. Because Memorial Day weekend last year, we fished over 100,000 pounds in 1 day. We do it Saturdays or generally somewhere in that 100,000 plus range. So if we tell you that these are the only 4 days, we would probably exceed the 547,000 pounds in 4 days.
That's
not what I want to do. I don't want people to panic fish. I don't want people to go out when the weather is bad. That's been one of the our concerns. So we are working through the Gulf Council to address that. The next meeting is in April, and we have to make some very tough decisions at that April meeting. But we're also looking at the Great Red Snapper Count that Senator Shelby provided some funding a few years ago to do a Great Red Snapper Count, and it has come to a close. The final report is about to come out. NOAA has the data from that, and conservatively, there's three times the number of red snapper out in the Gulf of Mexico.
Wait, and we're getting cut in half?
So now you understand my pain, and how I explain that to the public is a challenge because it makes no sense that that's where the discussion is going, that we have a greater abundance and we're looking to get cut in half. So now they would say that we could calibrate any extra fish and then bump you back up, but I have some different thoughts on that, and my staff, Kevin Anson, our chief biologist, a brilliant person, has worked very hard on some potential changes that and options that we'll present for the Gulf Council meeting to try and not get into. And they say in 2019 we overfished between all the sectors. And we
overfished based on the prior calculation of tonnage, which I can disagree with there. But if the great red snapper count comes out, says we have three times as much, we didn't fish three times more.
Correct. We only fished about 100. So out of 15.5 million pounds of allocation for commercial, recreational, and for hire, we overfished by about 150,000 pounds, according to their numbers. So. And one of those was a statistical challenge for some stuff in Texas. That was about 115,000 pounds. And so we don't even know what 2020 looked like. We don't have the federal totals from 2020 just yet. They should come out hopefully by this next council meeting, where we may not have even done that. So
is this a trend? And this is a little bit away from the site, but is it – I know you can only say so much, but is this a train when they that has – head speed, this locomotive that you can't stop that says we're going to cut it in half because of this, even though here's this piece of information. You got this April meeting. You're saying great red snapper count says there's three times as much. Are they saying, well, we'll have to get to that when we get to it. We're going to move forward with this.
So the train is about wager. Half speed right now.
Okay.
To say, because the great red snapper count is going to be included in what they call an interim analysis. It's kind of a real quick analysis of the red snapper stock. And so they'll take some data from the great red snapper count. They'll plug it into their equation, so to speak, and they're going to do that in March. And the last week of March, that gets presented to the what we call the SSC, the Science and Statistical Committee, and they get to make a determination that the science is done correctly or that they agree with it, and then it's moved on to the Gulf Council as a recommendation, as this is what the allocations, or excuse me, what the catch limit should be for the year, and then you use the percentages that are already in the system, but they still want to apply that calibration. And I still don't think we should do that. Mississippi and Alabama are the two that get cut dramatically. They cut Mississippi, which has, I think, the best reporting program in the Gulf of Mexico, 63%. And so
Who didn't get cut? Florida?
So the other state, Texas, would stay the same because they use their own data. Louisiana and Florida would potentially move up 6% because of they use a survey system of their own in that calibration.
Even though the methodology, and here that's a real honest opinion coming from the director of Alabama Marine Resources, you look across the line to the west and you say the scales and tails in Mississippi is the best, and they're penalized 63%,
yes,
even though they have the best system for the data?
That's correct.
Well, that's what a lot of people complain about is, you know, we're doing all this. Are we hurting ourselves by reporting all this?
So
I mean,
me say it before, that I'm using the numbers to support you, and now it almost turned around to look like it's the other way.
But that's what we've all thought.
The good thing is the numbers in Snapper Check support what the C-Lab does for us, and it also supports what the Great Red Snapper Count says is off the coast of Alabama. So we're of the opinion that we have, and the vessel counts that we used in a video program a couple of years in a row all supported the numbers and or very closely resembled the numbers in Snapper Check. So we think there are multiple methods that show that we are good off the coast of Alabama, that we are not overfishing off the coast of Alabama, and that our Alabama reef zone is really contributing to the abundance across the Gulf of Mexico. And the numbers that they're finding in the Great Red Snapper Count are not just on the reefs and things. It's those other areas, believe it or not, those flat areas that people thought didn't hold fish actually hold a lot more fish. And those are never accessed. Like, people don't go fish flat bottom.
Right. Yeah. But those are fish that got evicted from the crowded structure, and they're out there. Hey, can you hold on? We got to run to a break and come back more with Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon, our guest right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. All right, welcome back, FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. attending our conversation with Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon, looking at number one, Triggerfish Open on Monday, the questions around Amberjack, but the bigger question around Snapper. And by our conversation, you can't say anything yet. You can't say anything till what? March or April,
to
right?
The end of April. The council meeting will be April the 12th, and it'll run that week. And so on that Thursday will be the last day of the council when we have the full council meeting, and the motions will be on the table for how we move forward and some final votes. And potentially, now the Gulf Council is only makes recommendations to NOAA. They still have the final say, so they could disagree with what the council says. I think we're going to try and work to some solutions that everybody can agree with and that do not put us into an overfishing limit. Nobody will threaten to sue because you're exceeding the total ACL for all the sectors, and that we can move forward. And I want to move forward at least at a level that we've been fishing. And I think there's a method to do that, and we're working on that. And I think the citizens of Alabama deserve that. And we've had tremendous support from Congressman Carl. He jumped in. I don't know if he realized what he was getting into. Senator Shelby, I promise you, he will fight for this till the day he walks out of his office. And this is a priority item for him as well. So we've appreciated that support, and we're gonna make a path forward. It may not be the path that we exactly want, but my goal is that we make a path that we can all live with.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, make it where we can go fishing again.
Correct.
Somehow. I mean, it's just terrible that, you know, we ended snapper season last year, into 5 weeks or something?
It ended pretty quickly, July 3rd there, because of the amount
weeks.
Of fish that was caught early on. And then when we reopened, you know, we go through the data, we quality control it, we check all the things, and we had some residual fish. And it just got more challenging toward the end of the year because the hurricanes hit. The weather gets to be difficult the later you get in the year. So we ran late in the year last year. So when you look at the number of days for 2020, we fished like 45 days, 47 days, something like that. But we really only fished the first 20-something days of that with any effort. The rest of it was just open, but the weather was terrible, and it was difficult to use up that balance of fish. But we did.
Eventually. I mean, I tried to go in the fall, but it was rough.
Yes.
Hurricanes.
And again, which is the benefit of the state management, was that we had some residual fish. We were going to let you fish them, and we just stayed open until those fish were caught. And so and let me back up a minute. When we went to state management, if we had not gone to state management the year that we did, we were going to go to zero federal fishing days, and you would have not had a federal season, and I'm not sure what the process would have been to get out of that. So unfortunately, even if we fish 4 days this year, which I'm going to work very, very hard that does not happen, that would have been better than where we were under the federal system. That's a terrible comparison, but that is a true statement. So.
Yeah.
So it is April before we have more knowledge on this.
That's correct. And first chance I get, you know, I will make an announcement, and so I may have my own personal Mardi Gras parade in the downtown Mobile and Fairhope and Orange Beach just to let everybody know. But it's or I may leave the state. We'll see how it works out. But my goal is that we are at a relatively level fishing similar to what we fished these last couple of years.
Let's hope so.
Well, I hope we get that. I mean, this is a really good reason you don't want the government to get you health care. I can promise you that.
I'm the fish guy. I'll let you guys talk about that.
We got just a minute left here. Can you give me a quick tour through any data coming out from the flounder and speckled trout changes?
You know, we had some discussion about that. I've had people who have called and talked to me about how they've changed their style of fishing. They've been very supportive, and I've reminded people that it still takes about 3 to 5 years to really look at where we are with that, because again, last year would have been an anomaly of a year. A lot more people went fishing, but the rule was in effect, so that was actually a good thing. And I will tell you that we just spawned some flounder in our hatchery in Gulf Shores, and within the next couple of weeks, we're going to release, I don't know, just shy of 100,000, I believe, maybe.
How big are they when they release them?
They'll be about an inch, three-quarters of an inch. They're small, you know, and survivability is probably in the single percentage.
Because they're like potato chips. Little tiny.
But I sure enjoy watching them swim around in those tanks, and I'm very proud of our staff that's been working on this. We're working on a program with Auburn to do some cryogenic studies where we can store some of the flounder genetics so that we can ensure that we have diversity in our flounder system. So there's a lot of good things going on in that realm. And again, from what I'm hearing, people are catching good trout. And there's always some concerns with red drum. You know, they don't see the big ones at different times, but I think those fisheries are relatively healthy.
There you go. As always, we appreciate your time and you coming on the show with us. And we'll probably have other things to talk about in the meantime, but for sure, go ahead and book us some dates in April, right, to talk.
That'll be no problem. And like I said, I may actually come in the studio so we can talk face-to-face.
Very good. There he is. Director of Alabama Marine Resources, Scott Bannon. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, and we're out of here. Prep Sports Report on the way next. Talk to you next week.